But you have
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 13th.
You're welcome.
That's Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
First item of business today, I would like to announce that my declaration yesterday indicating the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2463 were adopted in error, Unfortunately, a majority of the members present voted in favor of the amendment, but that was not sufficient to adopt the amendment as our committee rules dictate that it takes a majority of the committee members appointed. Thus, six affirmative votes were required. I hereby now rule that the motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments failed. Having said that, the motion to report the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended was out of order. The clerk will remove the record that the motion of the motion and vote. Additionally, the notice of a possible minority report is out of order and thus is also removed from the record. The chair has directed the staff to schedule House Bill 2463 again for a work session on Tuesday.
How does the majority member file a minority report?
It's difficult.
our rules do not acknowledge partisan differences, merely issue differences within committees. There is no, you know, that's how.
Right. Harvard Law.
That explains everything.
Harvard Law. That explains it right there. Okay, thank you. Okay, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 151. Are they ready or they're out of the room? They stepped out for a minute.
Two both went to Harvard Law School.
One of them's ready.
Okay.
Yeah, 151. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 151 allows the Director of the Department of Human Services to appoint attorneys who can act as an appointed personal representatives or file a small estate affidavit for a decedent who received public assistance or received institutional care. Clarifies the attorney does not represent the Director of DHS when appointed. There is no amendment, there's no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact. Thank you.
Tricia Baxter, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery with the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to speak with you in favor of Senate Bill 151. Senate Bill 151 merely clarifies that the department's current practice and past practice of about 20 years is allowable under current law. It does two things. It clarifies that the director of the Department of Human Services has the ability to approve attorneys who are eligible to be appointed as the personal representatives of estates. Secondarily, it ensures that these attorneys are considered a qualified person to be appointed as the personal representative. As I said, this is a practice that the department has used without being challenged for many, many years. During this past year, our attorneys at the Department of Justice identified that there could be some risk in our current practice as it wasn't specified in law that this was allowed. So Senate Bill 151 will ensure that the estate administration unit at the department is able to continue its current practice in filing small estate affidavits and filing claims in those estates. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What prompted us having to bring this bill forward?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, Department of Justice attorneys that work with us on estate recoveries identified that there could be some risk here for the department. So under their advice, we brought this bill forward to clarify that this is allowable under statute.
Follow up for me. Was there any event that triggered them identifying that risk?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, no, there's not, but not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Ma'am, name, I forgot. Mrs. Baxter, thank you for your testimony. Could you please give me an example of when you would and when you would not do this? Because it's May.
Certainly, Chair Barker, Representative Whitman. Generally, the department will look at how much our Medicaid claim would be in an estate and how large the estate might be. And we really have no way of knowing that until a personal representative is appointed. But we do know if there's property that is held by the decedent. We know if there's funds available through bank accounts. So based on that information, we may or may not decide to do this. It's a cost-effectiveness determination. If we feel that we can recover sufficient funds to make this a worthwhile venture, we'll do that.
All up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm sorry, we've got a lot of work to do. But so someone dies and he owes the human services or Medicare reimbursements for what?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, the department, as you know, pays Medicaid funds out on behalf of clients. When they apply for services, they sign a document that states that upon their passing, the department can recoup those funds from any funds that are available in their estate. So we do that process.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Nobody?
I'll pass.
Okay. Paula Brown?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today to talk with you about Senate Bill 151. The department testified in the Senate regarding this bill. We took a neutral position. The Department of Veterans Affairs has been working with the Department of Human Services on an issue regarding protected persons that the Department of Veterans Affairs works with and provides services through our conservatorship program. Through our conservatorship program, the department is selected by the court to provide the services for these protected persons. These are veterans, for whatever reason, are unable to take care of their own financial affairs. In some instances, they've been taken advantage of by members of the public or, sadly, in some cases, even family members. The department's responsibility is to handle those funds appropriately, ensure that the veteran has the necessities of life, that we're taking care of rent and other issues they have. So our main focus is to help make sure that we're keeping them in a home with food and in a safe environment. In the instances when these protected persons pass away, and if they were the recipient of the Medicaid services, then the DHS, Department of Human Services, can file the small estate affidavits to recover or recoup those funds. However, in some instances when those funds are very small, and you heard Tricia Baxter talk about the cost-effectiveness of recouping those funds, in some instances when it's not cost-effective for them and they don't file those small estate affidavits, what happens is the department, as the conservator for the protected person, is unable to close that estate. So what happens is we must continue to report and do annual filings before the courts to account for those funds. So what we've been doing with the Department of Human Services is trying to work out a process through which those small estate affidavits will be filed in a timely manner so that we don't continue to have to go back to the courts for those annual accountings. We're still working on an interagency agreement. I believe we're going to be able to finalize that soon, but did feel that it was our responsibility to bring that to this committee to make you aware of that situation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
How soon do you think you might have that?
Well, it's really going to depend on how quickly it can move through the signature process, I believe, in Department of Human Services. We will have a draft agreement to them early next week. So as long as we get through our signature process quickly, I think we'll have an agreement soon.
Okay. I think we will not work the bill today. I'd like to have that completed before we move the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 151 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 286.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 286 repeals the Uniform Foreign Money Judgments Recognition Act and enacts the Uniform Foreign Country Money Judgments Recognition Act. Specifies parties seeking to enforce foreign judgment has the burden of proof and must file an action in court to obtain recognition of foreign judgment. Provides 15-year statute of limitations on enforcing foreign judgments. This comes from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now you see why I'm delighted to have four attorneys on my on the committee this year. Mr. Shetterly, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. For the record, Lane Shetterly, I'm distributing to you some written testimony. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but I do want to just briefly explain the role in which I am appearing in front of you this afternoon, because you will be seeing me in this role a couple more times this session. I'm here today in my capacity as a commissioner from Oregon to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. That's also known as the Uniform Law Conference. NCUSL, or the Uniform Law Conference, is an organization of the states. Members to the commission are appointed by appointing authorities in the various states. Those appointing authorities are established by state law. In Oregon, the governor appoints. In some states, it's divided between the governor's office and the legislature. But the upshot is that each state is represented by a group of commissioners, and the commission itself acts like a little legislative body. It meets in work groups, drafting committees around the country throughout the year, developing legislation, and then meets as a full conference in the summer to adopt uniform acts. The difference, of course, in the nature of its legislative function is that the acts that the conference adopts don't actually have any effect upon adoption, but then they are referred to the states for adoption to provide a uniform system of laws in areas where uniformity is important. A good example of a uniform law that the conference has passed and has been adopted in almost all states is the Uniform Commercial Code. We know that very well. Oregon has adopted just shy of 70 uniform acts already in the books. If you look in the index under the revised statutes under uniform, you'll see all the list of uniform acts. So the product of the National Uniform Law Conference is well known in Oregon. I'm one of four commissioners to the National the Uniform Law Conference from Oregon, and we're particularly honored this year to have as president of the conference our own Oregon Supreme Court Justice Martha Walters. And so it's a good year, a good couple of years for Oregon to have one of our own members serve as president of the body. So with that background just on what NCUSL or the Uniform Law Conference is, I'll spend just a couple of minutes on this bill. It's not a very complicated bill. It's an update of a Uniform Act that is already on the Oregon books. Oregon adopted the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments, the Uniform Foreign Money Judgments Recognition Act back in 1962, and over the years, of course, practices change, commerce changes, and in the 1990s, early part of the 2000s, the Uniform Law Conference established a new work group to update that act, and this bill before you today will adopt that amended and updated act. It clarifies that this act only relates to judgments for money that come from foreign countries. We also have in the ORS the Uniform Foreign Judgments Act, and in that case foreign means sister states. They're also referred to as foreign. Those are judgments that are entitled to full faith and credit under the U.S. Constitution. There's a very streamlined process for enforcing those judgments from other states. This deals with foreign countries. That is, judgments entered in foreign countries. It provides a process for filing for enforcement of those. It provides standards by which the courts are to measure the judicial system in the country from which this judgment came, so that it authorizes, in fact, directs the courts, for instance, not to enforce or allow registration of a judgment from a country and under a judicial system that doesn't provide impartial tribunals, those kinds of things. So there are protections in there against really some rudimentary and unfair legal systems around the world. It gives the courts the authority to inquire, and in fact it places the burden of proof on the party seeking recognition of a judgment to establish that its judgment comes under this act. It creates defenses that a party against whom the judgment is sought to be enforced can raise, and it clarifies the procedure, something that we did not have in the 1962 Act, for how this is done. It's actually done by filing a new proceeding, a sister state judgment you can enforce in Oregon just by filing a verified copy of that judgment in a local court. Because of the full faith and credit clause in this act, you actually have to file a new proceeding, that is, initiate a suit to establish the validity of the judgment. So it creates a little bit higher burden to get this foreign country judgment registered and enforced in Oregon, but it does create a defined process. The work group from the Law Commission, the Uniform Law Conference that developed this, was represented by attorneys who specialize in international law as well as courts. Comes to us as a product of that expertise in a pretty arcane and narrow area of the law, but one that is important for states that want to be players in the international marketplace, so that we have systems in place that will allow for enforcement of judgments entered in foreign countries. The reciprocity of that, of course, is that that will encourage other countries to recognize and enforce judgments of our courts as well. I don't have anything more on that. I'd be happy to answer any questions to you. The bill passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously. I believe it passed without dissent on the floor of the House. Comes to you. I don't think there's any opposition to it today. Pretty straightforward bill, but I'd be happy to answer questions, and I thank you for taking the time to hear it today.
Representative Garrett, please.
Mr. Shuttle, how many states so far have adopted the 2005 Act?
Do you remember, Ann? I think we had that question in the Senate committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Garrett, it's California, Colorado, Idaho, Michigan, and Nevada have adopted, and there's also 10 states that the legislation has been introduced in this year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I think this was actually passed finally by the Commission, the Uniform Law Conference, in 2005, so it's on the early edge of adoptions, but so far it seems to be passing.
Just a quick follow-up.
Easily.
Are there any states that in which this was attempted and that have declined to adopt it for any reason? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, not to my knowledge, although I don't track introductions, I track enactments. Okay. That's not to say it hasn't. I will say I have spoken with the staff at NACUSL, and they're not getting pushback on this. The reason I don't want to say no is that by virtue of legislative calendars or other issues, there may very well have been states where it was introduced and not enacted, but not on account of any substantive opposition to the bill.
Thanks.
Have a question.
Representative Krieger.
Yes. Laying the handout that you gave us, have you got that?
I do.
First, number one, the first sentence, not enforceable under this act, referring to the U.S. Constitution. What does this do and why, and can you explain what that does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'm sorry, the first sentence in mine says, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Section 1.
Section 1.
Okay. The numbered one on
the... Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, just pointed out that he was not thinking as a cop. I clearly understood that.
Sure, yes, the question sandbagged me. What this is, I touched on this in my remarks, and it's in part because we also have an act on the books called the Uniform Foreign Judgments Recognition Act.
Okay.
In that act, foreign means other states. Colorado, California, you name it. State judgments are entitled to enforcement in Oregon under the U.S. Constitution, full faith and credit clause. We're obligated to recognize and enforce those. We have systems and standards in place in our states that that justify the recognition of those judgments in Oregon. That is not the case in foreign country courts. And so this act makes a distinction that if you've got a judgment that is entitled to full faith and credit, it doesn't come under this act. This only applies to judgments that are not entitled to full faith and credit.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shadley, does the National Conference of Commissions on State Uniform State Laws have a position on the national popular vote? I withdraw that question. Excuse me.
Well, I almost want to answer that.
No, they should.
Thank you, Donna. Okay, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be with you.
Okay, yeah, good to see you again. Thank you.
You miss it?
Yeah.
Not this budget, you don't. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 286. Open a work session on Senate Bill 286. Discussion.
Lawyer should carry this one.
Yeah. Chair, I move Bill 286 to the floor with it be adopted recommendation.
With a due pass.
Due pass.
Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 286 to the floor with a due pass. Any more discussion? Roll call, please.
Representative Barton?
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
All I can say is that was great bedtime reading.
Yeah. Should we put that on the consent calendar rather than try to explain it? If anybody has questions, you'll refer to our lawyers.
I want to hear somebody explain this.
No, it's fine. Okay. It's more than fine. Consent calendar.
Oh, consent calendar. Go for it. That's even better.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 370.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 370 allows a limited judgment in probate proceedings to award expenses to personal representative, allows limited judgment in protective proceedings to authorize payment to persons providing services to protected persons. There's no amendment. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Maria Keltner, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Maria Keltner. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I'm a member of the legislative subcommittee of the State Bar, the Elder Law Section. The main focus of my practice is elder law. I deal with a variety of legal issues, including guardianships, conservatorships, and other issues that relate to elders. Currently, and the reason for this bill, Senate Bill 370, is that Oregon's probate law allows an order for attorney fees and fiduciary fees and costs. Fiduciaries are people like guardians, personal representatives of estates, people that are applying for conservatorships. In certain instances, the current law applies that there can be an order entered for fiduciary fees and costs and attorney fees and costs in these probate-type proceedings. In other circumstances, and in most circumstances, a judgment may be issued by the court after they review the documents that are submitted relating to fees and costs. This causes some confusion in terms of when an order or a judgment may be the appropriate vehicle for the court to award attorney and fiduciary fees and charges. So we're requesting, the Elder Law Section is requesting an amendment to two parts of the Oregon Probate Code, which would allow a limited judgment and therefore a method to enforce the award that the court has already issued on these matters. It would clarify that the court can order a limited judgment in all issues, not just in some for an order and some for a limited judgment. So I urge the Judiciary Committee to move Senate Bill 370 to the full House with a due pass recommendation. And I thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony today.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, this bill passed 5-0 out of the Senate Judiciary, and it passed 28-1 on the floor of the Senate. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 370. Open a work session on Senate Bill 370.
Mr. Chair, I move we refer Senate Bill 370 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 370 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitten?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries, and if everybody agrees, that goes on the consent as well. And I'm going to reopen Senate Bill 286 work session for the purpose of allowing Representative Barton to vote.
Aye.
Representative Barton votes aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session. Thank you.
Just do my bill, then I can leave. Those are for you. I have 2088.
Okay.
Sorry.
We're going to move down so we don't have to play too many musical chairs with the our legal assistants here. House Bill 2088. Open a work session on House Bill 2088.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2088, you heard on February 25th, that expands and increases the penalty for knowingly filing a false corporate document with the Secretary of State. It makes violations a Class A misdemeanor, declares emergency effective on passage. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And there's no revenue impact and no amendment.
Okay.
Why does it have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means if there's no... no fiscal.
Well, we have a minimal fiscal.
Oh, okay.
And it was assigned that at the Speaker's office.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay.
And colleagues, you recall this is the bill they testified about. They were looking for people who are intentionally falsifying things and not looking for somebody who makes an error in a small amount.
Knowingly.
They want people who knowingly are violating the law.
Yep.
Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Do we
have a motion?
I'm sorry.
And we need a motion that talks about the subsequent referral.
Okay.
Chair, I move House Bill 2088 to be moved to the be referred to the House Ways and to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves House Bill 2088 to Ways and Means with a due pass. Any further discussion? Call roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Yep.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And
okay, thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 2127.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2127 comes here from the DHS. You have the -3 amendments in front of you, or you should have the -3 amendments in front of you. And we just got them a little while ago. We have interested parties, Patty O'Sullivan, Cyril Hebb, and the lady from SIOU that I don't remember her name. And they'd like to discuss the amendments if they could.
Please come forward.
Maybe it's a -2.
-2.
Yeah.
Heart attack. -2. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services, and thank you
Mr. Taylor, for correcting the dash twos, not threes, because we're about ready to have a heart attack. We come to you with some agreed-upon amendments, the dash twos. I'm going to let Sybil talk about what is in the dash twos, since she's a lawyer and I'm not. So, Sib, if you want to go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. In support of the dash twos in House Bill 2127, we were in opposition to the original bill but entered negotiations with the department to work out the language of the dash twos. I'll summarize in short. House Bill 2127 proposes to amend the procedures that apply to service of notice in contested case hearings, contested case administrative hearings. And the bill, as originally proposed, would simply have substituted the requirement that those notices be sent by certified mail with the requirement that those notices be sent by regular mail. Because we didn't have an objection to that principle or that that actual application, but we did worry about making that change without also making some subsequent changes to the procedural presumptions that applied after the mail notice was sent. And so working with the Department of Human Services, we did make several other amendments to the bill that would say that if regular mail is used as the method of sending a notice to the party, then there are some provisions which allow that party to raise the claim that they did not, in fact, receive that notice because certified mail is a more sure way of making sure that a notice gets actually in the hands of a party than is regular mail. And so we're satisfied with the language of the dash twos because we think it protects the procedural due process rights of the parties, and we also think that it's fair to the department and works well for the agency. So,
and for the record, just in case some of you aren't here, we've been sending notices by regular mail since 1972, so nothing in this bill will change anything that we do. It's not intended to change anything that we do. The Law Center just wanted some protections in the statute that are currently our process within administrative rule. It just moves a couple of them into statute and makes them clearer. So we're quite happy with that. We've worked out the language. And then Megan's also here from SEIU, who has she kind of joined this very late, and neither she nor I actually know if there's any other problem. That we don't believe there is, but she just wants to make sure for the home care workers that nothing changes as well. And we don't want anything to change either. So we've agreed that she and I will, and she can speak for herself, but we've agreed that we'll continue, once this passes out of this committee, looking into how they currently get their notices and making sure that that process does not change. So if they currently get them by regular mail, which I think they do, nothing will change. If they currently get them by certified mail, nothing will change. So we're just looking at that, and she just wants to kind of hold the door open for the Senate side in case something needs to be tweaked. And I'm amenable to that.
For the record, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Megan Moyer, and I'm here representing the Service Employee International Union, which represents home care workers, adult foster care workers, and child care workers who, for a variety of reasons, would need to be sent a notice of contested case hearing, and the implications of failure to respond can ultimately result in the loss of their ability to be a provider, either for at that time or potentially ever with the Department of Human Services. So we have worked, and I greatly appreciate the work of Patty O'Sullivan on this issue, and I do apologize for the date in which I got involved in this issue, but we do have concerns, and we're working out with the department that nothing changes, that some of our workers may currently be getting certified mail, and that should not change due to this bill. If that is the case, for those who are receiving regular mail, we're not requesting that it move to certified mail, and the ability for a provider to bring up the concern that they did not receive it is very important to us, that, you know, if there is an issue where they do not realize that a contested case hearing notice went out and proceeded and a judgment was found without their knowledge, that there would be a way for them to legitimately bring up that concern and a process for them to have that situation rectified.
That's Okay. Representative Stigler.
And I don't care who answers this, but I understand you're talking about not changing methods of notification of you know, current providers, current workers, et cetera. What happens from this day forward with respect to any new folks that come online that would come under this statute?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, and that's exactly Megan's concern is if they're currently sent something by certified mail, does this allow us to change that? And
I understand that. I'm talking about new people. I'm not talking about anybody existing under the current law. I'm talking about anybody.
They will be treated exactly like this.
Okay. So
nothing changes.
My bottom line question is, are they going to then receive their notices by regular mail? Is
correct.
That the intent?
That's correct.
Okay. So what we're talking about here is protecting. And that's, I'm trying to get to exactly understanding who's going to get what. And
I can try, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Stiglin, committee. The department has a set of procedures right now. Currently, the APA requires certified mail for all contested case notices. In some circumstances, the department has not been, the practice has not been to use certified mail. In other practices, it has been. I think their choice made was sort of to try to effectuate the best notice possible. I think what they're saying, what the bill does with the amendments is it gives them the option to do certain types, to use regular mail instead of certified mail if they choose. It says, if they use regular mail instead of certified mail, then the following procedural protections will go into place in order to make sure that those people get the same due process or equivalent due process as people who get certified mail notice. Yeah. I think the department's proposal is that they will not change the way in which they're currently sending notices out. So a new service provider would get certified mail if other service providers are currently getting certified mail. So I think
that's what I was trying to clarify is who is going to be getting what from this point. I mean, I understand existing providers, but from this point forward, so I wanted to be really clear that everybody was understanding that
that's a good question.
If it's a classification of providers that have currently been getting it, even though they come on new, the consensus of opinion is those folks, even if they're new, will continue to receive it by certified mail. If it's an area that the practice has been regular mail, that's what the continued practice will be.
Representative Stigler, that's correct. I knew that in my head, and my mouth just said something different.
Just want to make sure we were all on
the
same page here.
They weren't connected just for a second.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Sullivan, I take it even though the statute will not require you to do so, you will follow current practice and procedure by using certified mail. And my assumption is that you will memorialize that in regulation as it relates to home health care providers and others similarly situated.
Council Taylor, that's what Megan and I are going to work out in the next week or so. Right now, we don't have a list of her represented workers and what they get by which kind of mail. We're going to look at that first and then determine if we need an amendment to this or we work it out by rule or we work it out by agreement. We don't know because we don't know what that list looks like.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel. This bill's not ready to go out today because we don't have the fiscal back yet, but the intent of the bill is to keep doing things just as they've been doing without changing anything. And if we pass this, I will read that in as legislative intent so there's no confusion about it. Right. And we're not going to be able to move it, but we can adopt the amendment. I would accept a motion to adopt the dash twos.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Chair, I move the dash twos in the 2127.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash twos in the 2127. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Close the public hearing close the work session on House Bill 2127. Open a work session on House Bill 2139.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2278 comes to you from the Attorney General Hardy Morris for the Department of Justice. And is that the number? And did you say 2139?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, House Bill 2139 was supposed to come off the agenda because we still haven't got the. They're still working on amendments. We don't have
39. Okay. Close the work session on that I opened on 2139. Open a
work session.
Work session on 2278.
Chairman of the committee, what you had was an earlier agenda, and that bill had been removed. Okay. So we're now on 2278. And that comes from the Department of Justice, and it relates to child support. Provides a judgment for child support awards expire 50 years rather than the current 25 years. The amendment before you, the Dash 2 amendments, which is agreed to by all the different parties, substitutes 35 years for 50 years.
Okay.
So that would be down on line Dash 16, two. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, where it says 25 in brackets, and then bold 50. The bold would be removed on 50, and inserted would be a bold saying 35.
So we don't have dash ones on
there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash two amendments we're looking at. The dash ones are no longer a viable document.
Okay.
No one could understand them for one reason.
Okay, we have a dash two amendment which changes the length of time of the bill from the length of the judgment from 50 years to 35, the Dash 2 amendments. I accept a motion to move the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 2s in the House Bill 2278.
Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 2s in the House Bill 2278. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. No, it's a work session, so.
All the parties have agreed to
that. Yep.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move we send to the floor of a due pass recommendation, House Bill 2278, amended with a dash 2, as amended with a dash 2.
Representative moves House Bill 2278 to the floor with a due pass as amended. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Martin.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Would somebody like to carry that? No.
Sure.
Representative Stigler will be the carrier. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2453.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2453 comes to you from Representative Barton. Extends the attorney-client privilege to include an agent of the client. You have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you, and you may remember the discussion we had about this bill the other day. Mr. Ugler, that testified here, I work with he and Legislative Counsel's Office concerning these amendments, and you see them in front of you. The representative of a client means, and it describes basically what it is.
Mr. Chair, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you perhaps recall when you grilled me on this for about 30 minutes a few weeks ago. The Dash 3 relative to the Dash 2 is a fairly minor change. It was made, you might recall, at the suggestion of Mr. Ugler. Currently, Section B follows the Uniform Evidence Code Rule 502 verbatim. I believe that I've worked with various interests and groups in this, and I believe there's no controversy regarding this. At least I'm not aware of any at this time.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Just a question, and in the hopes of developing a whole set of questions from every member of the committee on this.
I'd like that, Representative. Bill. Thank you.
The Dash 3 amendments we have, does this cleave exactly to the model rule that Mr. Ugler was referring to? Is there some deviation, just for a piece of minor curiosity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I believe that the Dash 3 amendment, specifically subsection B, cleaves to the Rule 502 of the Uniform Evidence Code verbatim. Candidly, the Dash 2 amendments were designed to do so. I was not aware of any substantive difference. In fact, frankly, as I read it, I didn't see a substantive difference between the Dash 2 and the Dash 3. Mr. Ugler disagreed and believed there was a subtle but potentially significant substantive difference. And frankly, just to get perfect consensus, and also because that ambiguity might end up litigated someday, we have the Dash 3s.
And now, and the Dash 3s not only are no substantive difference, but are just the same words? as the model rule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. The only thing I want to clarify again, which I brought up before, there was some concern that this couldn't be used by pimping it. He couldn't say that my prostitutes, my contract employees, Council Taylor has pointed out that would be an unlawful contract, therefore it wouldn't apply. But there was some legitimate concern. We didn't want the unintended consequences of criminals being able to use this to get around the law.
Mr. Chair, this Dash 3, this Uniform Evidence Code, is enacted. I don't know how many states, but I believe the I speculate that it's every state but Oregon. I'm unaware of that unintended consequence occurring anywhere. I think it's extremely unlikely.
Thank you. Council. Well, go ahead, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say very clearly to the record that it is, I know my intent, and I believe the intent of the drafters and people who will vote yay on this, to cleave to the model rule, and to the extent there are any differently placed commas, it would not be because of a substantive difference of the model rule, but our hope is to use the same words as the model rule. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, also, it just, you reminded me, I might not have introduced myself for the record. I'm Brent Martin, State Representative of House District 51. I believe I am the primary drafter of this bill,
yeah.
And it is my intent in doing this to cleave to the Uniform Evidence Code, Rule 502.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
it came up in the...
Don't testify during a work session.
Independent contractors. Covered? It's the intention to cover them.
Mr.
Or at
Chair,
least not to categorically exclude them.
Mr. Right. Chair, Representative Garrett, yes, that's my understanding.
And the reason I'm asking is because we still have the phrase
scope
here,
of employment.
Scope of employment, and this came up in the last discussion, but I gather that the Uniform Code has been interpreted to cover independent contractors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, that's my understanding.
That's
correct.
The committee's intention, I think.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Barton, in the interest of cleaving and independent contractors, I just want to make a point here. This bill, even with this amendment, is a good thing for businesses in this state, correct? To help them stay in business,
Mr.
and
Chair,
potentially
Representative Cameron,
avoid
problems. I believe so.
And those are the kinds of bills that we need, because this will help Joe Smith, who's looking for a job. Thank you.
My dad. Mr. Chairman of the committee, the issue has been raised about the issue of people involved in criminality, and arguably they may have some kind of relationship with someone else, but I would assume that that relationship would be not recognized in law because it would be an illegal contract.
Right.
Therefore, these provisions would not apply, and someone involved in a criminal activity could not raise this issue legitimately to silence their agent from testifying in court.
Thank you.
Silence. Thank you for bringing this bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I forgot it was a work session. I don't know why I came up here.
Mr. Chair, are we in a work session?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 3s to House Bill 2453.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash 3s in House Bill 2453. Is there
discussion?
Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2453 as amended with the Dash 3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2453 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Any discussion?
Did we move the Dash 3s in?
Yep.
Yes.
You already voted for that.
Call the roll,
please. Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Yes.
Representative Schill?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
I'll give a courtesy aye, but may refuse on the floor to ask questions of the carriers. Friday the 13th. Aye.
Jeez.
Aye.
Chair, I beg of you to shift this to the consent calendar.
Representative Barton will carry the bill.
You can beg all you want.
Oh, dear Lord.
That's good try, dude. Good try.
Just a Krieger.
You need to watch our cameraman in the corner, because when he's laughing and slapping his leg, it's getting out of control.
Probably also getting on the record. Signing the die tape, so you've got to be careful about that.
No further business to come before the committee. Adjourn.